Okay, thank you. Good morning. As with in just about any discussion that we have of increased urbanization, development of transitional areas from suburban to urban, we're usually always talking about one of the primary concerns being stormwater runoff and how do we manage that in those different areas. Polluted stormwater runoff is a primary concern in terms of water quality issues in the United States. We know those pollution in that stormwater runoff can come from many different locations, and it usually just depends on the environment that we're thinking about. If we're looking at urban environments, a lot of the pollutants are going to tend to be more things from industrial sources, hydrocarbons and metals. Think of the runoff coming off of roads. If it's suburban, then we really do see some issues of nutrients, definitely from lawn fertilization, and then pathogens as well. If you have aging infrastructure, leaking sewage systems, then you can see some pollutants coming from there. Also, transitional, so whether you're looking at construction areas, you have some problems with sediment there. Agriculture, obviously, we want to address that, and that's not just, of course, field agriculture, but nursery production, those types of things. So we are concerned about the runoff from there and then erosion. So we do need some strategies to kind of address those issues as part of the landscape, things that we can incorporate into the landscape as we are building those environments. And one of the ways to do that is through low impact development. And so low impact development is a strategy to manage stormwater and actually treat stormwater as a resource rather than a waste product. And so, you know, I like to think of it as, it's like, hey, it's free water for your landscape. And so can we harvest that and trap that and make good use of that? I just put in here this final point just so that we don't, it doesn't get confused with LEED, which is a building practice. That has to do more with the construction of the actual building. So low impact development strategies really do pertain more to the landscape. And so what the goal is of low impact development is to reduce the impact of stormwater in those built areas that we are using. Try to sort of, you know, we always want to kind of just mimic nature, right? Because that's the best pathway. And so even though we are modifying the landscape and the environment, then trying to perhaps restore and mimic and recreate some of those natural hydrologies as much as we can. And then also to sort of keep that functionality there. And so we do want to try to focus on prevention rather than mitigation. So what can we do at the time of construction that will actually help eliminate some of those potential potential problems? And so we're looking at stormwater infiltration. We know that can be a real issue if you're talking about impervious surfaces, as well as any sort of soil compaction that's coming from construction. So trying to continue to address and improve stormwater infiltration, limit the soil disturbance when possible, maintain original vegetation if possible, and then really trying to preserve any existing aquatic ecosystems and not cause any damage to those. The nice thing about LID is that the goal is to focus on simple, small-scale, low-tech solutions so that any, like an individual could do in their own residence, their own landscape. And so it's not just something large scale that's expensive that, you know, you have to be a builder to do. And we want to try to incorporate then some of those small efforts throughout the landscape and just to kind of makes it a little bit easier to implement. And so when we talk about LID landscaping, we're really, this is kind of the fun part for us, where the plants come in and the horticulture plants come in. I'm involved with a lot of different research groups, and there's always a soil water quality person, a soil chemist, physicist, landscape architect, but they, in the end, they always need a plant person, and so that's me. So you still, in the final step, you have to get the plants in there. And so we do want to utilize plants and perhaps some modifications of the soil to just kind of mimic those natural systems to increase water use efficiency, increase water infiltration into the soil, improve water quality by filtering out some of those pollutants. And then the nice part about it is that, you know, it ends up looking great. So we add that aesthetic quality of life value as well. And so obviously it's going to be, the implementation is going to be unique to each site depending on the you know, factors and the conditions that you have there in that particular site. What is the infiltration rate of the soil? You do need to check that. The soil type, is there compaction that needs to be addressed? What is the capture potential? So how much runoff are you hoping to capture in that particular area? You know, an area for containment is not unlimited, you know, so it can only deal with a certain amount of runoff. And then looking at the vegetation that's on that site and then trying to either, you know, copy that or do something similar. And so the top LID practices I have listed here, and so we won't talk about all of those. The ones that I'm talking about today is rain gardens. Could also be bioretention. Bioretention tends to be just a little bit larger scale, something that you might see on a commercial level, where whereas rain gardens, that would be something small scale that you would actually, an individual property owner could do. Okay, and so this is an area in the landscape designed to capture runoff, whether it's coming from a driveway, a road, compacted soil, a rooftop. So water, that stormwater that's running off from those impervious surfaces, you're designing an area on the property to capture that water on site before it enters into the stormwater system. You know, I think a lot of people look at stormwater running into the storm drain and they think, oh, that's on its way to the wastewater treatment plant, and it's not. It's headed to the nearest natural body of water. So we want to capture that and try to treat it before it goes off site. Now, this is not a bog or a wetland, so it doesn't stay inundated or flooded the entire time. There is definitely that fluctuating hydrology, and that's kind of what makes it an interesting challenge for choosing plants for that, because there are plants that have to kind of tolerate those fluctuations in hydrology. So again, it is a rain garden is designed to capture and hold stormwater runoff to improve infiltration, remove pollutants, filter out sediments. And then there may be some amendments needed based just on how much volume of water you're trying to capture and then the soil type. And so the nice thing about this is as we continue to develop these, we see lots more examples of how attractive these areas can really be. It used to be, if you Google image a picture of a rain garden, it was just this weedy mess, right? And so that's not something anyone wants in their landscape, but we're seeing a lot more options in terms, even in levels of formality, the types of plants that you can choose, the design. So really, whatever your area you're designing in, you can match that rain garden to what you're already working with. And so usually these are going to make use of native soil, at least for rain gardens. You may have some amendments just depending on the soil type. Sandy soil, you're usually looking at amending with perhaps some compost. Clay soil, looking at adding something for a little bit larger particle size. And then you're also interested in how long it takes for the rain garden to drain. Usually we want them to drain within 48 hours, and perhaps even less than that, more like 24 to 48 hours. Now, you will see some recommendations for amendments to the soil. You may see amending with organic matter. You may see amending with sand. Some of these substrates, these first two, the sand, organic matter, those are ones we tend to see recommended typically more for bioretention, whereas rain gardens really is just the native soil and perhaps you incorporate some compost or organic matter. But we can also see it done without any amendments at all, so there are some options there. Okay, so again, the part that we're interested in, though, are the plants. And how do we choose plants for rain gardens? We know that they need to be able to tolerate that that fluctuation of periods of inundation, complete soil or substrate inundation, followed by draining or drying when we don't anticipate there would be any additional water or irrigation added to that system. And so, you know, we look at lists of plants that are, you know, wetland status indicator plants and ones that are we find naturally growing in low-lying areas, and that's kind of where we start in order to get ideas or suggestions for plants to use in rain gardens, but we still need to kind of evaluate those in a controlled environment. And so here's just some other examples of really just something even on the bottom left corner, something very small, up into a large sort of more municipal scale, and then even just the variation in design that we can see. So they keep getting prettier and prettier. This is something we tend to see probably more out west. This is a common incorporation of rain gardens into municipal areas. Okay, and so when we start with plant selection, we can kind of just basically go back to the original design principles that you learn in every landscape design class at the very beginning. You're thinking about year-round interest. You're thinking about a variety of forms and functions, different textures. Again, you could go very formal. I've seen some that are very, very artistic, like at an art museum, so it's actually kind of part of the art itself. Some that are more informal, so it's really, there's so much flexibility in designing these. And of course, you know, if possible, you want to maintain the existing plants. This is a bit of a challenge, though, if you're actually going in and excavating the soil. How would you keep that? I have seen rain gardens built around things like birch trees that were already in existence, so it's a little bit tricky, but it is possible to maintain some of the existing vegetation. Of course, it's very popular to promote native plants these days. I personally really like native plants because I find their ornamental attributes tend to be somewhat more sophisticated, and so I really like using those plants in these types of gardens. And then, of course, looking at plant diversity. And you're looking, again, at also your site, so it's like you're starting with any sort of typical site analysis. And so we would expect those plants that are indigenous to wet areas that they would do well in this particular type of use. And then we want something, we also like to attract beneficial insects, and I'm going to talk about that with one of our plants we screened in just a little bit. And so we do know from the literature and in some of the studies that we've done, polyculture is obviously an advantage. And we've seen this not just in rain gardens, but we've seen this a lot in green roofs as well. So diversifying the growth habit and form to get different ecosystem services from the different types of plants. You know, some for shading of the ground, some for fast uptake of the water, some for slow uptake of the water for drought tolerance. So you really want to have that mixture of different plants, or as a polyculture, just for improved efficacy of the garden. And so, again, also by sort of reducing any sort of seasonal gaps in vegetation, we want uptake to happen in the winter, too. Okay, so not just in the summer. So having a mix of evergreen plants, deciduous, herbaceous, perennial, annual. In our research, we haven't done a lot with evaluating annual species. That may be something that we do next. So far, we've just looked at perennials. But we want to see, as was mentioned a little bit ago with the blueberries, shoots in the spring, roots later in the year. It's that kind of thing. You know, we want those growth flushes and periodicity to kind of, you know, they can kind of trade off among the different plant species throughout the year. One of the things I just skipped by, one of the things that we've seen in our research is that we looked at some issues evaluating substrate type, and what we found the biggest impact of substrate type was is not so much of the absorption of nutrients to the substrate, but the plant health. So the better the substrate was for the plant, the more the plant grew and the more uptake there was of nutrients. And so that's kind of like our focus that we want, is to, you know, what's best for the plant, and I think that's going to make the most successful garden. And then keeping in mind that there are different moisture zones in the garden that, around the upper edges, which tends to be a little bit higher. That would be a dry zone, and then the center would be a little bit, stay wetter longer. Okay, so what we've done is we've designed, we were using some Rubbermaid tubs for a while, but we found that they didn't last very long outside on the nursery pad in the summer, so we've gone to actual nursery containers, and these 97-liter or 25-gallon containers, we order them just regular, so with the normal drainage holes, or we order them without holes. And the ones without holes, then we can fit a valve to, so we can actually control flooding. And so we can water the non-flooded plants as needed and just grow those. And then the flooded ones, we can actually close that valve and flood those. And so there's the valve system that we have. The valve would be on the outside of the container, and we can just open and close that. And so when we're flooding them, we close the valve, we water until the water reaches the surface of the substrate, so it's completely inundated. We let that sit for 48 hours, and then we let it drain, and we don't add any more water during that time. We've done draining for 5 or 7 days, but I think what we need to do is actually extend the draining period, because as we're seeing with some of our ferns right now, what seems to be getting them is not the flooding but the drying, and so it could be both. If it's a small plant, we can put 2 per container. If it's a large plant, we can just put 1. So here was one of our most recent experiments. The lobelia is the red flowered one, looking really great there. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Okay, so we can measure lots of things to evaluate the plant performance and tolerance to these conditions. Obviously, plant growth, substrate moisture, we can look at nutrient concentrations. Right now, we're looking at some stomatal conductance and leaf chlorophyll, and then total leaf area, just to see if that's an indicator of flooding tolerance, photosynthesis. And so far, we've screened several species directly. The first part of the list here are some deciduous shrubs, and you can see there's scientific names there, and whether or not it's suitable for a rain garden or not there on the right. What's interesting about this is if you look at like the Clethora and the Viburnum, I say yes, no. Well, in one experiment, we were working with small plants, and they were not tolerant of flooding. In another experiment, we were working with larger plants with a larger root ball, and they were tolerant. So it does appear for some of these, perhaps maybe marginal species, that we need to perhaps have a larger root ball at planting. So we're identifying some ones here that are obviously different growth forms that are tolerant, and then looked at some sedge or grass and some perennials. We did not have good luck with echinacea, even though it appears on almost every recommendation list, but we think maybe it's probably one for that drier zone, the upper zone of the rain garden. The lobelia, it seems to be tolerant of flooding, but we had some pest problems, so we couldn't actually quantify the growth. But if you're trying to attract beneficial insects and wildlife, so then maybe that means it's a good choice. We do see that vigorous root growth is key for survival in these rain gardens. And we do see, if you think about a typical root ball coming out of a container, it's a sort of a vertically oriented cylinder. What we've seen is the ones that are tolerant tend to reallocate their root growth up into the upper layer, so there's more oxygen, and so they can kind of adjust that root system architecture to survive those flooded conditions. Larger root systems at planting, we think that's important. We tried some with flooding pre-acclimation, and we didn't see any benefit of that. We do typically see some reduced canopy volume as well as root system volume, but no correlating compromise in visual quality. We do see that plants seem to be the primary factor for removing nutrients over the soil. There are several different aspects of the soil of the plant physiology we can measure. And then again, looking at a plant's native ecosystem, not just in terms of flooding, but it seems like that some plants that are from nutrient-poor ecosystems actually do a better job. It just depends on the ecosystem they're from, whether they can take up lots of nutrients and store those for later. Okay. All right. So there's lots of references. I'd be happy to share those. Just in conclusion, this seems to be an effective and easy, low-tech way to manage some of these urbanization issues. And so the plants are going to tolerate periodic flooding and draining and having a variety of plants in there to have year-round functionality. I'd like to just acknowledge my graduate students and my other cooperators, and we have time for questions. The question is there a difference between bioretention and rain garden? It's generally an issue of scale. So bioretention is larger, what you might see for manage runoff from like a large parking lot in a commercial area. They are ones, bioretention, that generally tend to utilize more soil, more sand in some of their substrates. Rain gardens are generally just smaller scale, kind of on an individual basis. Yes, sir.
I guess it'd be more of an issue for the larger scale urban ones, but are there any concerns with the accumulation of toxins, heavy metals and such running off?
The question is there any concern, particularly in the larger scale ones, with the accumulation of toxins from runoff? And that is a great question, and most of these ones that we've evaluated, we don't know because they're so young. You know, it's kind of like with green roofs. We have like about 2 or 3 years of data maybe, and that's it. And so that is the big question that we're, you know, that keeps coming up every time we discuss this. At what point do you go in and do you remove the plants, remove the mulch, and start over again? And then once you've removed that, what do you do with it, you know? And so we're not sure. Yeah. That's a good question. Okay. Thanks.